Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. As the American slow walk talks and Israel obstructs them, the region and the world is moving on. The U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance says the U.S. hopes to transform the Middle East. Well, this has already happened. It's called the end of the Sykes-Picot era. Crosstalking the struggle for peace, I'm joined by my guest, Joshua Landis in Oklahoma City. He's the director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Oklahoma. In London, we have Ashish Prajar. He is a former advisor to the UK Middle East peace envoy and a political strategist. And in Tehran, we cross to Mohammed Hatibi. He is an analyst on Iranian foreign policy. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Joshua, let me go to you first. I'm titling this program, The End of Sykes-Picot. Am I being premature, or am I off the mark? Maybe you could explain the term for everyone first.
Well, Sykes-Picot were the British and French negotiators, the French foreign minister, who at the end of World War I divided up the Middle East, creating some of the broad boundaries between Syria, Iraq, Israel, Palestine, so forth. And they're responsible for the great carve-up of the Middle East. Now, Middle Easterners have been talking about trying to undo those lines, those colonial lines, as they say, but I'm afraid they're stuck on the map. Today, nation states, whether it's Syria, Iraq, Israel, Jordan, seem to be fairly permanent, and states like Turkey and so forth are defending their borders tooth and nail. So I don't think Sykes-Picot is going away, but certainly this is changing the balance of power today.
Yeah, but Joshua, I think we would all agree that the spirit of Sykes-Picot is gone, okay? It's no longer a neo-colonial project. I think we've broken from that. Iran certainly is making it a point. All right, Ashish, let me go to you, London. In London, give me a report card on the Memorandum of Understanding, because, you know, I watch it like everybody else, watching it very closely. It looks like a reality TV show in Washington, and Iran is just saying, no, we didn't say that, okay? It seems to me the Americans are trying to renegotiate the Memorandum of Understanding in real time on their terms. Go ahead, in London.
Look, I think anything with Donald Trump is its constant renegotiation, but a lot of it takes place over social media, right? So, right. Yes, there might be a Memorandum of Understanding that both sides have agreed to continue negotiations, but it's also the reason Iran have walked away three times from the current negotiations are because Trump has either threatened them or changed what is in the Memorandum of Understanding. But they expect this too, right? I think Iran go into this, and obviously we have an expert from Iran on this, go into this knowing how Trump acts. And they've obviously got their agreed of how they're going to react to his bluster, to what Americans are saying. I would also say that this Memorandum of Understanding, no matter how it's played, it actually, America's, it's good for America because they were leveled on the battlefield.
Yes.
Everybody covering this fairly knows that American bases were being evacuated. Iran has successfully decolonized West Asia and the Middle East. Radar stations, the early warning systems, they're all gone because they've been destroyed by ballistic missiles. You know, they've definitely, you know, yes, the Sykes-Picot comment you made is really relevant because they have pushed the colonial powers back to at least majority of it being in Israel, right, and the Israeli occupation. The rest of Western forces in the region are constantly worried about this barrage of Iranian ballistic missile. And the Memorandum of Understanding gives America, I believe, a break in a weird way, their own win, for domestically, for their audience, because Trump definitely needed this to kind of end before his midterm. And I say this because there's definitely, whatever is agreed, if anything ever is agreed in the 60-day negotiation period, there's no doubt in my mind that Trump will try and renegotiate that once the midterms are out of the way.
Right.
They can deal with his domestic audience. So nothing he's done on paper is relevant. And look, we all have to go back to the U.S. and Iran had a deal over the nuclear arms under Obama, and the Americans just tore it up. So knowing that that's the way they can and will behave, Iran, I think, is prepared for that outcome regardless.
Yeah, it seems, Mohammed, let me go to you in Tehran. It seems like the Iranians really planned this? I mean, it's, you know, if the Americans appear to be playing one-dimensional checkers and the Iranians are playing, you know, five-dimensional chess here. I wouldn't use the memorandum of understanding. I wouldn't use that term. I would use the term conditional surrender on part of the Americans. Ashish, I agree with him in London. You know, this is far, far from over. And I think the 60-day thing is more of it's a narrative that helps both sides navigate moving forward. 60 days, not a lot is going to be accomplished. Go ahead, Mohammed.
So as you said, and the other guest said, this is not over yet. And I think that Trump will try to either renegotiate it or start a new war against Iran, because this is not what Trump expected. Before start of this war, Trump set objectives that none of them are achieved. There is no regime change in Tehran, and its nuclear capabilities are still here, and he wants them badly. He wants access to Iran's high-level enriched uranium right now, and Iran is not willing to let go its nuclear program once and for all, because it has lost a leader over it and have endured over 20 years of sanctions. Iran gained leverage by closing the Strait of Hormuz partially, and it is trying to enforce its sovereignty over this important strait. And Trump didn't expect that. No one actually expected Iran to go this far to pressure the global economy. And I think that Iran sees itself the winner in the short term, and that is why it is adjusting its terms on that. And so walking away from the negotiations by Iran is a sign that it will not surrender. The Trump administration cannot achieve what they haven't achieved during the war. And I think that Iranians know this well, and they are trying to negotiate and get more concessions from the United States. As we see in this memorandum, this 14-point memorandum, Iran has gained a lot, and it seems that nothing has been offered to the United States. I think that if Iran's late leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, was alive, he wouldn't doubt about signing this MOU, because this is just the same as the JCPOA during the Obama administration, as our other guests said. And I think that this is a back down from initial objectives by Trump administration, either to buy time or, as I said, to improve the logistics in the region and start a new war.
You know, Joshua, the biggest sticking point here, I mean, Trump wants out of this, okay? It's his worst nightmare. Israel helped him get into it. He is ultimately responsible for it. But Trump's biggest problem is not really Iran. It's Israel.
Yes, there's no doubt that Israel has become a very troublesome partner. And we're in the middle of a campaign where pro-Israeli money, of course, is extremely important in the United States. And that all raises a big question mark over candidates in the United States and over the Republican Party's future. But if we bring it back to President Trump is desperately trying to look like a winner in a situation where, as your guests have very clearly laid out, the United States has been a big loser. It didn't get regime change. It couldn't blow apart the missiles and the drones of Iran. And it couldn't open the straits of Iran without making a diplomatic deal. And today, you know, the two major things that have blown up most recently are the question about whether the money that was going to be Iranian money released to Iran would be spent on American farm goods, and whether inspections would go ahead, UN inspections inside Iran. And in both of those, in Switzerland, the diplomats were talking about both those things. So there was an element of truth to this. But the point is, President Trump pretended that they had a deal, that America was going to get everything it wanted, when, of course, it hadn't signed anything. Iran hadn't signed anything. And this threw the Iranian negotiators, of course, for a loop. And they immediately denied that any deal had been made. And we take two steps back for every step forward that's made. And unfortunately, this is the, you know, this is the style of the Trump administration, because he wants to look like a winner. And he thinks he's negotiating by throwing out these social media claims.
Well, and on top of it, Joshua, threatening the delegation. I mean, my goodness. I mean, that's a violation of the Memorandum of Understanding itself here.
It is. It is. And the Secretary of State, who's now traveling to Kuwait and the UAE and Qatar and so forth, he is trying desperately to repair the relations which have been so damaged between the United States and the Gulf states. And Saudi Arabia isn't even honest. I think the Saudis have said, we don't want to see you. We don't want to talk to you. They're just angry.
Well, it's no surprise that they are. Sheesh, before we go to the break here, I think the Gulf monarchies are talking to Iran.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's very clear that they've got no trust left in the United States. The United States showed the world who the only person they're willing to protect here, or the only entity they're willing to protect in Israel. They let the Gulf states get battered. They evacuated their personnel. Yes, Americans died. They evacuated their personnel and left those states defenseless. All the interceptors that you supposedly, successful interceptions by Gulf states is just propaganda. They were level two. The reason money is flowing out of Dubai, Kuwait, and even Saudi to a degree, is because it's not safe for people to keep their resources, money, and business there anymore. You have Dubai, for its first time in its history, offering half rent.
Yeah.
You know, these are things that if you don't want to believe the American narrative, just look at the economics of what's going on in the region right now. So Iran is definitely the one that they're talking to. And when you said at the beginning about the Sykes-Picot thing, it didn't even realize Iran is going to be the gatekeeper of who's going to be not in control of the Middle East, or how foreign policy is going to be done in the Middle East going forward. Look, they are the only ones demanding a ceasefire, a permanent ceasefire in Lebanon. They're the only ones demanding that Israel pulls back and unilaterally, you know, and they are unilaterally making sure that is in the agreement. This is Syria, Turkey, Egypt, anyone else. They are demanding that, and they will not continue these negotiations if Lebanon is not at the center.
Okay,
Ashish,
hold that thought. We have to go to a break, and after that break, we'll continue our discussion on the search for peace in the Middle East. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the struggle for peace. Okay, let's go back to Mohammed in Tehran. I think a question that everyone really has on their mind, we've already talked about the obstruction of the Israelis vis-a-vis Lebanon. How long, and I know you're not a policymaker, how long can we expect Iran to be patient? Because we've already seen that Iran will take the decision to strike Israel if its demands are not met. And Israel is doing this ridiculous tango with the Americans right now. How long before Iran says enough is enough, maybe return to kinetic action or just walk away? Mohammed.
I think that Iran has set red lines already, and it is attacking southern suburbs of Beirut, Zahia, and also there is ground operations ongoing in southern Lebanon. Iran is trying to push the Israelis from southern Lebanon, and I think that Israel, if it dares to conquer some of the cities there, including Nabatiya, which is a stronghold for Hezbollah, Iran may start retaliating, and it has set that clear in the negotiations and in the whole talks in general. I think that Iran is willing to stop this war because it does not want a cycle of war and peace, which have been ongoing about two or three times right now. And I think that Iran wants a permanent solution to this mess in the Middle East. And United States tries to blame everything on Iran, but it is Israeli policies that are destabilizing the region, Israeli actions in Lebanon, its war on Gaza, and its expansionist policies in Syria are all fueling this fire. And I think that Iran is the only country in the region that wants this to stop. I think the Arab countries of the region have recognized that whenever there is a fight in the region, the United States will choose Israel over them. And I think that this is the reason they are trying to talk with Iran and solve their problems with Iran. they think that the security umbrella provided by United States is no longer valid, and they are trying to find new partners. I think Russia can be a good partner for them, as well as China, and they are already trying to be closer to them, and we are seeing some signs that show that. So the balance in the Middle East is changing, and I think that Iran will be more active in the future because the equation is changing right now. Before this Iran war, the war against Iran, Israel was gaining momentum in the region by expanding its operations in Lebanon, in Syria, and other regions. But after this war happened, the equation changed a lot because Iran did not lose. Iran just won by not being defeated by the United States and by resisting the actions and the war against it, and by gaining leverage over the global economy. So, as I said, the equation is changing. And as you said, there is ongoing developments that will shape the Middle East future. And I think that Iran will play much more important role.
It has to play a more important role. Joshua, I mean, it's, we have a Middle East security architecture right now that is intentionally not allowed Iran to be part of it, and actually it's against Iran, and that we have to come to a new equilibrium. Iran is there. It's a major power. It is more powerful now than it was before the war, and now we have a new equation. I mean, you don't have to like Iran or Iranians, okay, but, you know, if you want peace and stability in the region, all major powers have to be have an agreement on having stability for all. That's the only way forward. Go ahead, Joshua.
You're absolutely right. And this brings us back to the Sykes-Picot idea. You know, a debate is raging here in foreign policy circles over whether this new balance of power with Iran establishing itself as being able to defend itself against the American empire, if you will, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. And Americans are divided on that issue because there are a number of policymakers who've said this could bring a new stability to the Middle East because it will end this dream of an American empire. And as we know, Israel and the United States hoped that they could destroy the Islamic Republic, overthrow the Iranian regime, and end this axis of resistance forever. That's what they thought they could do, and turn the Middle East into a Pax Americana and an Israel-American sea of control. And that dream has gone up in smoke in most recently. And now the question is, what does it mean to have Iran survive this? And not only survive, but be able to get an income, because that's what's been most important for Iran, is how do we capitalize, how do we monetize this new security, the fact that we've survived, and get money and get our oil out and begin to rebuild so that we can become a power in the Middle East. And that's the big question. And Lebanon is sitting in the middle of it. And as you said, Lebanon is going to be the real fulcrum, because yep, Israel is not giving up on Lebanon and control of Lebanon. And as Iran is trying to use Lebanon as a wedge to split the United States from its Israeli client. And it's not clear that Iran can do that, because yes, Trump has threatened Netanyahu. He's said bad words about Netanyahu, but nowhere has he taken one bomb away one away from Israel.
That's right. And I've always said, don't be fooled by the theatrics, okay? Actions matter. Words are cheap, particularly with this administration and the current government in Israel. Ashish, you know, if we have, and I think it's in the cards, that's why I wanted to talk about Sykes-Picot. You know, Iran is going to be returning to its natural state of order in the international system. It has been the United States, with the help of the Israelis, to kneecap Iran for the last 47 years. Now, Iran is going to return to its natural state in the region. But if it does, and I think it is, then that marks the end of the Greater Israel Project.
100%. I mean, the Greater Israel Project relies on the United States' complete investment in it. The issue for them is also the U.S. is changing, right?
We're seeing election results change.
We're seeing commentators from Tucker Carlson to people who would be on their side in general about all this stuff demand American presidents not act to fund Israel anymore or fund its wars. Now, Israel's trying to buy time so it can start its own military-industrial complex. It's not going to be enough. Iran has developed a phenomenal arsenal, but also now is building bridges and relationships with all the countries around it, from Pakistan to one side to Turkey. You're seeing potential Middle East pacts coming together to form their own version of NATO. Israel could find itself in a year or two being absolutely isolated. And there's no real interest for Europe to tie that. It's in the long run, obviously, you're going to see continued Israel has the right to defend itself jargon coming out of European leaders, and the head of the EU doesn't really represent European people. But the reality for Europe is, with all the deliberate tactics by the United States to cut off maybe gas and oil from other parts of the world to Europe, it's becoming increasingly dependent on certainty. Absolute certainty in resources. And they need Iran potentially to be successful. They won't admit this at this point on exporting its resources because it's facing its own energy crisis with constant issues with issues that they have frankly caused with their support of a what I think is a lunatic regime in Ukraine at this point. They're bombing gas pipelines to Europe. They are self-sabotaging. So they need Iran and other powers in that region, other partners in that region, to continue their supply. Especially, look, I always said this at the beginning of Gaza. What would have been the most powerful thing for the Middle East nations to do to stop the genocide was cut off gas to Europe. They can do, and today it's been done by Europe itself by funding, like I said, Ukraine and America doing other things across the world from Venezuela and everything else. And they can't just rely on America for that. They need Iran. So Iran is definitely not just a power. It's in itself, through energy, a superpower in this moment. And if it is building better relations with its current Gulf allies, all that oil, all that gas coming out there, there'll be agreements about who, when, prices, they will distribute it to the rest of the world.
Well, I see. From what I understand, there's a lot of people knocking on the door in Tehran. They'll pay in crypto. They'll pay in their own currencies. Mm-hmm. They want to get away from the dollar trap. Mohammed, and I'm sure Joshua will agree with me because we're close in age here, but we were brought up, Iran is full of lunatics and they're suicidal and they're crazy. And you know what? Over the last year, who is the adult in the room? Who's rational? Who comes, the 14 points? Who wrote it? The Iranians wrote it, okay? Every step of the way, because Ashish brought up, the lunatics in Europe, okay? They don't even know their own self-interest anymore. And we have this steady hand in Iran, in reintroducing itself to the world, I would say. Go ahead, Mohammed.
Yes, as you said, Iran is the rational actor here. During the conflict, Iran did not completely close the Strait of Hormuz. It allowed some ships to pass, and it only closed the strait for the hostile ships, including Israelis, the United States, and its allies. It allowed ships from China, India, and Turkey to pass. Also, Iran just retaliated to what Israel done to Iran's infrastructure. Iran did not target the Persian Gulf countries' infrastructure until it was targeted. The proportionality of these strikes is really important because Iran had the capability to target pipelines in UAE, to target Saudi Arabia's Aramco, and so many other infrastructures in the region, including the internet infrastructure down below the Strait of Hormuz. And it was able to push its allies, including the Houthis in Yemen, to close Strait of Bab al-Mandeb, which would have pressured the United States even further and the global economy as well.
Mohammed, I'm sorry we have run out of time, but I would like to note that it was the Americans on the first day during this war that killed 168 children. That was either AI or intentional or a mistake, but that's how it all started. Gentlemen, fascinating discussion. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. I want to thank my guests in London, Oklahoma, and in Tehran. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules. We'll be right back.